I brought it back up. I remember there's sometimes, for a few of you, some confusion about some terminology, usually having to do with just plain old English words. Yeah. Is the mic on? It's on. Is it working? Yes. Is it working now? A little better. Okay. Too loud? Too loud now? No. Okay. We were talking about purification of proteins last time with all these few methods, electrophoresis, gel filtration, etc. And we're talking about separating molecules, one from the other, one kind from the other, like all the blonde people from all the brunettes and the redheads. That's a way of separating. But the English word separate is also used if we wanted to separate the amino group and cleave it off of an amino acid. Cleave it, we separate it from the rest of the molecule. And those are two completely different meanings. And some of the problems, you say, could you tell the difference between these two molecules by gel electrophoresis or by hydrolysis, for example? So hydrolysis is the second kind of separation, like I'm going to separate your head from your body, not separate the brunettes from the blondes. And so the English fails us. It has these two meanings. So we have to take the word separate in context. When we're talking about purifications, we're keeping everything intact. We're trying to purify something in its intact state. Once we start to break bonds, we've destroyed that state, so there's no point in separating it. On the other hand, sometimes we want to cleave a peptide into two subpeptides, and we're separating the peptides into many subpeptides. So you have to be careful of the word separate. All right, last time we got about halfway through our discussion of enzyme kinetics, introduced enzymes. I tried to get a little movie of enzyme in action. An enzyme that's dear to my heart that I've worked with, dihydrofolate reductase, a vitamin metabolizing enzyme. And if you'll find, if you look at the HTML version of the web notes, right at the beginning, say, click on this movie, and you see the movie of these substrates coming in, the enzyme kind of actually opening a door so that the enzymes are not these static things. And that ball I threw around in the jacuzzi is not a completely accurate state of a protein that's an enzyme. The enzymes have a certain dynamism to them. They can open a door, take in a substrate, and close the door behind it, or partially close it. So the enzyme can take an active role in binding, and of course an active role in facilitating the chemical reaction that takes place. So you can see that reasonably easily in this little movie. So I advise you to click on that movie link at the top of the lecture 7. So we were talking about enzymes, characterizing their activity, their velocity, their initial velocity, with respect to the amount of substrate that's present. And we can learn a lot about the enzyme by doing that kind of experiment. We already found out how we could find out how good the enzyme is at facilitating that reaction, what its Vmax is, and more importantly for the enzyme, in general, what its turnover number is. So the Vmax is an operational definition depending on how much enzyme you have, but turnover number, K3, can be written down in a book and characterizes an enzyme and a substrate. So if the enzyme has more than one substrate, or if you try to fool it with another synthetic organic compound that also acts as a substrate, but it's not the same as the real substrate, the enzyme could treat that substrate a little differently. So that number is only good for a partnership between one enzyme and one substrate. So there's another important piece of information we can get from these V0 versus S plots. And that's the Km, which we'll talk about now. So we already talked about Km a little. It has several definitions. See if this is working. Nope. So the Vmax is telling us what the asymptotic limit is as we increase the substrate concentration to infinity here. And at zero, we have no activity. But in between, we have this curvature. And so we have, and the Michaelis-Menten equation is explaining that curvature. It's and so how can we get an easy way of looking at this curvature using the pieces of the Michaelis-Menten equation that we know, right? Well, let's consider one way of looking at the curvature is how much substrate you need, say, to drive the reaction this far. Well, how much substrate? It's very hard to say how much substrate you need to get to the Vmax because it's actually, since it's asymptotic, an infinite number of amount of substrate. So that's not a very good number. But you could say, what does it take to get to 90%? And that's a number, or 10%. But let's take 50%. If we take 50%, that tells us sort of a distance. This curve could have been steeper, in which case it would just take a little bit of substrate on this particular scale to get to one half the Vmax, or if it were more shallow, it would take more substrate. So it's a given enzyme and its substrate could have that characteristic distance. So if we... my remote is not working. Is it plugged in? Yes. So if we consider that value, we can ask, what is that substrate concentration that drives the reaction to one half the maximum velocity, right? Maximum velocity for this amount of enzyme, right? And we go down there and we say, what is that substrate concentration is a certain molarity. And it turns out that that number is equal to that old Km, the Km that we originally defined as K2 plus K3 over K1, just to gather those constants, those little k's, to make the Michaelis-Menten equation look a little less busy. So numerically, the Km is equal to the concentration of substrate needed to drive the reaction at half the maximum velocity. And you can easily satisfy yourself that that's true. Just set V naught to be one half V max and solve that equation for S, and you get Km. And it will take you about 15 seconds if you sit down and do it this evening. So let's think about what the Km might mean, if that has any additional significance to us. And it does. Here's that first part of that Michaelis-Menten mechanism. E plus X, S goes with K1 and back with K2 to the enzyme substrate complex. Let's, for the fun of it here, reverse this and think of it the other way. The enzyme substrate complex is dissociating with, just keep our K's, our K1s and K2s correct, ES going to E plus S is K2. So it goes and dissociates into enzyme plus free enzyme and free substrate with the rate constant K2, and it associates now to the left with K1. What's the equilibrium constant of this little reaction, this part reaction of the whole mechanism? Well, it's just, this is incorrect. It should be E times S divided by ES, right? The product of the products divided by the product of the substrates, which in this case, substrate is a single. Now, that equilibrium constant written backwards here is also equal to the ratio of the rate constants in the appropriate directions. The forward, as written, the forward reaction rate constant divided by the backward reaction rate constant. That is not obvious, but in the web notes, I derive it in about 5 lines, and it's all very straightforward algebra, and just based on the mass action, tenets of chemistry. So I won't take time to go through that derivation here. So you can say, you can check on me, and that the KD, or the dissociation constant, that is the equilibrium constant of the dissociation reaction, also called KD, the equilibrium constant of the association reaction, we call K sub A, is K2 over K1. Well, that's a little bit like Km, not quite. Km is K2 plus K3 over K1. Now, just if K3 were less than K2, so is that reasonable? Is that a reasonable assumption? We can rationalize it by saying, well, let's look at the whole mechanism here. K2 is just breaking apart what you just formed, this ES. They collide, and then the enzyme lets go of its substrate. To do K3, it's got to change that triangle into a square. So that might be a little harder, and that might be a little slower. So Michaelis and Menten might have said, well, so let's consider if that's the case. Often that is the case, but often it's not the case, that it binds very tightly, the enzyme, and the conversion to product can go very fast. Still, enough times, maybe the majority of the times, this is true. And if it's not completely true, it's partially true. So we have an approximation that Km is often approximately equal to Kd, which is, that is, K2 over K1 is approximately equal to Km. So that Km, and since K2 over K1 is Kd, the dissociation constant, we can then follow that Km is approximately equal, often, not always, to the dissociation reaction, the equilibrium constant for the dissociation. So that's telling us something about how tightly the enzyme binds its substrate. So if you have a very low Km, it means the dissociation is very infrequent, very hard to dissociate. It means the enzyme's really good, tight, holding it at many points, doesn't let go of its substrate very easily. The dissociation is poor, means the enzyme is good at binding. The affinity for the substrate is good if the Km is low. And conversely, if the Km is high, that means the affinity is not so great. The enzyme is poorer if we think that enzymes should bind with great affinity and specificity. They usually go hand in hand for the substrate. So what are some of these numbers? Since we considered numbers for Vmax, for a turnover number. So one micromolar, 10 to the minus 6 molar, that's good. That's not many enzymes have that. Some have even better, 10 to the minus 7th, 10 to the minus 8th even. But that's already good. 10 to the minus 4th is sort of average. 10 to the minus 5th, decent. 10 to the minus 3 is already poor, right? Still, many enzymes, which are doing their jobs, they're not pressed into service, that's not going to be used. They're, all these enzymes are doing their specific jobs. They find 10 to the minus 3 molar is plenty good enough for what they have to do, because maybe because there's always plenty of substrate around. Maybe glucose is a substrate, and you're always providing a ton of it in minimal medium, right? So there is this range over several orders of magnitude. So with these two constants then, K3, the turnover number, and Km, an imperfect but useful approximation of the affinity of the enzyme for its substrate, we have a pretty good feel for how good the enzyme is in both the things it has to do, bind and transform. And that's basically all it has to do, right? So the Michaelis-Menten equation turned out to be a powerful way of looking at the action of the components involved in this process, and has application beyond enzymes. Any process that's saturable, that's the key thing here, is that steady state. You form the enzyme substrate complex, and then you're in a steady state getting forward or going back. Ion channels any kind of molecule, that one molecule that binds another, can be described with this kind of equation very often, and you can learn something about it. You can compare two enzymes based on their KMs. You can compare a normal enzyme, just as we compared sickle hemoglobin with normal. We can compare an abnormal enzyme, say, to do some genetic disease or some manipulation you do in the laboratory to change your protein into something else to see what happens. You can compare what the effect is on Km, what the effect is on K3, and it tells you something about what's going on. Now let's talk about the modulation of enzyme activity. And we'll talk about, so you could modulate an enzyme, you can think of logically two ways. You could make it go faster, and you can make it go slower. And we'll just talk about inhibition, although activation also takes place. It's not all that different from inhibition. So There's many kinds of enzyme inhibition that have been classified by biochemists for various reasons, and we'll talk about three of them. The first one and the last one are the most important. The middle one is mainly there for comparison purposes, right? For contrast. So the first one we'll talk about is the easiest to understand, and that's competitive inhibition. So with competitive inhibition, you could have an inhibitor, as shown here in graphic 5, that looks like the substrate. It's got this pointy end to it. Right? So it fits into the substrate binding site of the enzyme, maybe just as well as the substrate. If it were just as well as the substrate, then the its dissociation constant, which we can't call it a Km, because the inhibitor is not a substrate. If the inhibitor were a substrate, it would be called a substrate. If it's not a substrate but still binds and gets in the way of the substrate binding, then it's an inhibitor. So this guy is not going to be changed, this I. It could be the same, in which case its dissociation constant would be the same as the Km for the enzyme, approximately. Or it could bind more poorly, but you could add a lot of it and would still get an inhibition because it would just compete with by numbers with the substrate. Or it could bind with even much greater affinity than the substrate. What's always true, though, about competitive inhibitors is that you can always get rid of the inhibition just by adding more substrate. Because since they're both competing, not only is the inhibitor competing with for the enzyme with the substrate, but the substrate is competing with the inhibitor. So that if you add enough substrate, even in the presence of a given amount of inhibitor, you can always swamp out because you can add, in theory, infinite concentration of substrate. So you can always add enough, even if the inhibitor binds with 100 times greater infinity, you can add 10,000 times more substrate and swamp out the inhibitor so that you no longer see its effect. So that's characteristic of the of a competitive inhibitor. Two things is that you can swamp out its effect by adding more substrate, and that it should look very much, at least piece of it, a part of it, should look very much like the substrate itself. And let's look at that in more detail. Let's look at the consequences of this mechanism then on our V-naught versus S plot. So here's the situation in graphic 7 with the without inhibitor, minus inhibitor. And I've made this a much steeper curve here now by manipulating the scale, let's say. So here's our V-naught on the ordinate, although not shown, and substrate down here on the abscissa just as before. So here's the Vmax over at the end here. And where's our Km? Here's our 50% point. And we just go a little ways out, and we're there at 50%. There's our Km. Okay. Now we add a certain amount of inhibitor. If we add tremendous amount of inhibitor, the curve would just be a straight line at the bottom. We'd have nothing to look at. So we add a certain amount of inhibitor that's interesting, right? A sub-saturating amount of inhibitor. So at this amount of inhibitor, we see, yeah, there's a big inhibition, about 3/4 down. And then if we add more substrate, it's only about 50% down. But if we run the reaction with even more substrate, we have less inhibition. And you can see that this line is going, as we go to infinite substrate concentration, they're approaching each other. So that in fact, the Vmax is the same, either with or without the inhibitor. So you just have to add more to get to that Vmax. You have to add more substrate in the presence of the inhibitor because they're competing, right? What about the Km, on the other hand? If we assume now the Vmax is the same out here, way out here, then 1/2 Vmax is exactly the same place. And if we look at how much substrate, what substrate concentration is necessary to drive the reaction at 1/2 this maximum 100% velocity, we get a Km that's much greater than the original Km, a measurement of Km. Is that buzz? All right. Face this way, maybe. So the measurement of Km now gives an apparent Km that's much greater. You'll see that in some texts they say, well, the Km has changed. I like to think of Km as basically K2 plus K3 over K1, which is characteristic of the enzyme and its substrate and can never be changed. That's written down in a book. So it's just the apparent Km that's changed. And as soon as you see the apparent Km has changed and the Vmax isn't, you know you've got a competitive inhibitor, even if you didn't have the help of the little diagram, which actually, this comes first. Then you say, ah, I have a competitive inhibitor. So what good are competitive inhibitors? Where do we find them? saw what I said on graphic 8. Here's a famous one. Where you find them is in drugs. So competitive inhibitors are important in medicine, in the pharmaceutical industry, and for our health, right? So I take a lot of pills. One of them is for this pathway. A lot of people do. This is a pathway. It has a lot of strange names like isopentanyl pyrophosphate. That shouldn't scare you away. It's just a biochemical pathway. It ends at cholesterol, something we know about. We know the structure of cholesterol. We also know cholesterol is necessary for life because it's part of our cell membranes. It's doing a good job in there. We also know from reading the papers that cholesterol, too much cholesterol is bad for you because it can lead to and exacerbate the formation of plaques in your arteries and give you heart attacks and occlusions, right? Atherosclerosis. So you make cholesterol and you make it through this pathway. You also eat cholesterol if you, unless you're a vegetarian. So if you have too much cholesterol, which you get measured when you go to the for your annual exam, and they say, well, you have too high a cholesterol, you better change your diet. And I say, no, I don't want to change my diet. Give me a pill. So they say, well, you better do both. So I take the pill and I change my diet a little. So what they give me is something that inhibits this particular step, HMG-CoA. We'll look at the structure of this in a minute. This is the enzyme that changes HMG-CoA to something called mevalonic acid or mevalonate. And so it stops this pathway. It doesn't stop it, but it slows it down. Slows down the pathway, so you don't make that much cholesterol. And if you have a good diet, then you don't eat as much cholesterol either. You don't want to take it to zero because you need cholesterol to live. But you take it down, and it works. Here's what it looks like. The one I take is Synvastin or Zocor. And here's HMG-CoA reductase. So it's got this structure with this carboxyl group over here and a C double bond O and an OH. And you could bend it into a form that's almost a ring. The inhibitors complete that ring. Most of these, well, not all of them, but Synvastin completes that ring and ends up, it's got the C double bond O here and the OH up here, but here it's a little different, just O instead of double bond O. So it can't be exactly the same, and then the rest of it is different. So this Zocor binds to HMG-CoA reductase and competitively inhibits the real substrate from getting in there and therefore slows down cholesterol biosynthesis. In your web notes, you'll also see allopurinol, which is a drug that stops the enzyme that makes uric acid, which I also take. So I make too much uric acid, kidney stones once. So now you learn all about my foibles. That's only two. So, very important for not only for medicine, but also for basic science. So that if you hook up with an organic chemist and say, well, how is this enzyme working? I bet you, you know, that's this methyl group that's fitting in over here. I say, well, you know, I can make something else with the methyl group over there and it won't be a substrate. Let's see if it's really important. We'll make it with and without the methyl group. And sure enough, with the methyl group, it inhibits the enzyme. Without the methyl group, it doesn't. So you knew that methyl group was important for binding. So you can probe the active site just by making these various inhibitors. See what's a good inhibitor and what isn't. And you know what functional groups or what parts of the molecule are doing, are fitting into that site. You can sort of map that site a little bit, which would help you also in the rational design of new drugs. There's lots of enzyme targets out there that need inhibitors and not enough inhibitors for them. The traditional way for isolating these things is to make 30,000 different organic compounds or isolate them from nature, from sewers and swamps, and purify them and put them in bottles, and then when you have your target enzyme like HMG-CoA reductase, you test each one and you have a robot doing 30,000 or a lot of people doing 30,000 different tests, and then you find 10 which look good and 9 are toxic, and then one works or doesn't, right? The rational design would be to sort of map that active site, get your three-dimensional structure of the protein, design an organic molecule that would work, give it to the organic chemist, says, no, it's too hard to make. He said, well, maybe we'll cut a corner here. Okay, let's try that. So sometimes that works too. And that's always very satisfying when you rationally design such a competitive inhibitor. So does all binding of enzyme have to be competitive like this? No. For contrast, let's look at a non-competitive inhibitor. So non-competitive means it does not go to the active site and stop the substrate from binding, compete with the substrate from binding. It's non-competitive. And we'll start this time with the kinetic result. If you had an inhibitor that did affect the Vmax, so that if you had a lot of this inhibitor, you get nothing. So you add less of it, add just a little bit. Here's without an inhibitor, the top curve here in black, and there's our Vmax. Now you add a little inhibitor, you've inhibited about 20%, and you have a lower Vmax. And with more inhibitor, you get even less. And yet more inhibitor, you get even less. But if you look at the curvature of this thing, you find that to get to this lower Vmax, the amount of substrate necessary to get to this new Vmax is the same as with the normal enzyme. The measurement of Km remains unchanged. So it's just the opposite of the competitive. And the word is just the opposite, non-competitive. The Vmax is affected, but the Km is not affected. So what's going on there? How could that work? So here's my picture of it. Imagine this beaker with 6 million molecules, now represented by 6. 6 enzyme molecules that have this crinkly surface. Here's the enzyme binding site, as usual, on the right here, this big Pac-Man mouth. And the substrate is going to fit in there with this yellow triangle. But in addition, we have this red non-competitive inhibitor. Moreover, this enzyme's got this little mark on it, supposed to be a lightning bolt, which indicates there's a amino acid side chain or a couple of side chains that are near the active site, that are in the active site, near the substrate binding site, and that's why I'm making this distinction, that participate in this reaction. Enzymes can participate in a very bold way with these reactions. The boldest is they take the substrate and they form a covalent bond with the substrate. Now there's our substrate. It's got to be made product. Now you're attaching it actually to the enzyme. Enzyme can do this to one of its side groups. Then, in the first step, then in the second step, say it hydrolyzes that bond. And when it hydrolyzes it that way, a product is formed. And the enzyme's back to where it was. So the enzyme satisfies its condition of being a catalyst and being unchanged by the reaction. But in the middle of that process, it was changed, but then changed back. So enzymes can be not only opening doors and shutting doors, they can actually engage in intermediate chemical reactions. So if you have something like this, that is not involved in the actual binding, usually they're right there in the binding site, but not always. So we have this situation. Now what happens when this competitive inhibitor is binding to that facilitating side group here? Now the enzyme can bind the substrate, but it can't do anything with it because the key tool it had for effecting this reaction has been blocked by the inhibitor. So out of these 6 molecules, first of all, only 2 of them have bound substrate in any one time, which is sort of reasonable. It has a certain Km, so a certain equilibrium constant. These are the guys that could go on to form product, but this one is not going to, because it can't, because its red non-competitive inhibitor is bound there. So it's just going to sit there until this finally dissociates. This guy will convert his triangle to a square and go on. But before, in the absence of the inhibitor, we had 2 of these guys doing it, now only 1. So the competitive inhibition, if we expand it to 6 million, is about 50%. The other way of looking at this is that we have 6 molecules here, and 2 of them have bound competitive inhibitor. 4 of them have not. The 2 that are bound non-competitive inhibitor, the 2 that have at the moment they have the non-competitive inhibitor bound, those guys, those enzyme molecules are out of the game. They're on the sidelines. They can't do anything. Instead of 6, we have only 4 that are playing. Right? So we've effectively dropped the amount of active enzyme from 6 to 4. So it's like drop the E naught in a way. And so our Vmax is lower. So that's why it agrees with the results plotted in the V naught versus S plot. The Vmax is down because the amount of functional enzyme is down. The enzyme that's left is perfectly fine enzyme as far as binding its substrate, so it exhibits its own real KM without any interference from any competitive inhibitor. So I present this just to show you that not all is competitive inhibition. There's a possibility for something else. Still at the active site. There's not too many examples of this. Usually they turn out to be poisons. Here's a poison, mercury. So mercury will bind sulfhydryl groups. Sulfhydryl groups, the side chain of cysteine, is often involved in facilitating chemical reactions. That its ability to get oxidized and give up that hydrogen atom with its electron is useful in certain chemical reactions, right? So here the substrate is bound very nicely in its substrate binding site, not affected by this cysteine side group. But if mercury sits down here, then the reaction can't take place. So that's a documented non-competitive inhibition. Now it's working. So, this is from your handout. Three kinds of inhibition. Here's uninhibited, here's competitive inhibited, here's non-competitive inhibited. I don't know what this little jigger is, it shouldn't be there. And we have one left, allosteric, arguably the most important from a biological point of view. Allosteric inhibition. So what's that? Allosteric, allo means like another place, something else, allo, not the same. Steric is in space, another place in space. So the site at which allosteric inhibitors work is completely independent of the active site. It's not the substrate binding site, it's not any other part of the active site that's facilitating the reaction, it's somewhere else in the protein. Traditionally, in these Scientific American type of pictures, it's put on the back. It could be anywhere. And we're showing it as a monomeric enzyme, which is not really very typical. Typically, enzymes that are subject to allosteric inhibition are heteromultimers, often say heterotetramers. And they might have two of their subunits then. They have two different kinds of subunits. Let's say they have a pair of subunits that are catalytic subunits and that actually do the job of the enzyme. And the other two subunits are regulatory subunits and contain this allosteric inhibitor site, which is going to do the inhibition. And when they get together, that inhibition takes place. It takes place by telegraphing. It's kind of a signal. Here you have the substrate binding site. It's a very fine, even though it's kind of narrow here, the substrate is also narrow. So the substrate fits very nicely into this narrow cleft in the absence of any inhibitor. If an allosteric inhibitor is bound to its site on the other side of the enzyme here, you can imagine that it might deform that site. Again, if you look at that movie, when substrates bind, they often deform the site. And when anything binds, those side groups can be pulled in. Just as the substrate can be pulled apart a little bit to facilitate the catalysis, so these free-swinging side chains can be brought in to envelop the substrate through the same kinds of weak bonds we've been talking about. But when that happens, it could pull a little bit of an alpha helix, maybe unwind a little end of an alpha helix, or pull a strand of a beta sheet out, or just pull a loop over a little bit. And that has ramifications for what was attached to that loop. Maybe it was just nicely balanced between these two other points, and now one's pulled away. So you get a cascade of deformations that take place, and you get such that the other end of the molecule, of the protein molecule, is affected by binding the allosteric inhibitor to one site. In this case, we make it easy. The effect of binding the allosteric inhibitor was to just close down that substrate binding site. It doesn't have to be as extreme as this. Just a little bit so that the substrate can't fit in anymore. Now the enzyme can't bind. What's been affected? Well, the KM has sure been affected because the affinity is way less. But it doesn't have to be the KM. It could be anything. It could still bind the substrate, but now it can't carry out the reaction. So the turnover number could be affected. Or they both could be affected. So the allosteric inhibition is much more complicated. There are ways to treat it graphically on V0 versus S plots, but that's beyond the scope of this course. But if you take biochemistry, you will see such plots. And they're kind of S-shaped curves. So where do we find this allosteric inhibition? I'm not going forward. Can I go backward? I seem to have crashed. Let's see what we can do. Oh, it's just slow, very slow. Oh, I said that. I have no mouse. Let's try getting out. Okay, let's see. What else do I have to say? I have to make a decision as to whether to reboot, which will take 5 minutes, or to go to the blackboard. There's a lot of stuff to write down on the blackboard. So I think we're going to have to reboot. Wow. Control Alt. Ah. What happened? Finally responded. All right, we have this one. I might as well talk about it. The allosteric inhibitors then are used by the cell. They are the natural inhibitors that the cell uses. And they're used in several different ways, but the most famous and the most satisfying and the most common way they're used are to control biochemical pathways. So we had this pathway. Now it's responded to my shutdown, I guess. Let's try just restarting this. So suppose you have a pathway A to B to C to D. I'm not going to remember exactly. And you have intermediates along the way. You can have an intermediate that is an end product. That is, you have a branched pathway. You have there's no mutual exclusivity between an intermediate and an end product. So suppose you have a branch pathway that's making three different end products. Now, each enzyme has its own Vmax and its own Km, and so they're not necessarily going to run at the same rate. So here's our branch pathway. So perhaps this 5 and 6 run, you get to E, and then F and G form very quickly, and you have a lot of G. Let's say these are amino acids, and you're going to make a protein. Now, you don't know how proteins are made, but you can imagine their amino acids are tacked on a certain sequence, and you need all 20 of them. So if you have plenty of G, then that's fine. But let's say you have not enough J, because this is a slow reaction. So meanwhile, the G, you're running this whole pathway over here, and the 5 and 6 are very fast, so you're building up a lot of G, and you're just waiting. As soon as the J is, you put it in the protein. But all this G keeps piling up. What a waste. What a waste of all this carbon from our glucose going into G when you already have enough G. So all of these pathways that end up as monomers for fatty acids, for amino acids, for nucleic acid precursors, for sugar precursors, for amino glucose or whatever for the cell wall, they all have this property that the end product, when you have enough of it, feeds back and through allosteric inhibition stops its own pathway, but only its own pathway. Because it wouldn't make sense for when you have enough G to cut off this whole pathway at step one, because you're waiting for the J. If G would inhibit step one, you wouldn't be able to get any J. So the rule is, and what evolution has sort of beautifully produced is that G inhibits only the first step in the unique part of the pathway that's committed to G, and so on. That little tiny pathway of one step there, and M over there. So this is how allosteric inhibition works in the cell and why it's often synonymously called feedback inhibition. And it's just like a chemical plant where valves are automatically controlled. When the vat is full and you're making too much of one thing, you'll start to constrict that valve and constrict the flow of reactants into that product. Here's a real case. It was one of the earliest cases studied. This all came out in about the 60s. Isoleucine is made in a pathway where threonine is an intermediate. It's another amino acid that also goes to protein. This protein thing should be down here. This is graphic 15. So the first committed step to isoleucine, starting in the middle of the pathway with threonine, is threonine deaminase. It takes the amino group off of threonine. Later, the amino group is put back on, right, to make isoleucine. And isoleucine then inhibits threonine deaminase. And because it binds to a different site in the enzyme, it need bear no resemblance. It's not competitive inhibition. Here's the side chain of isoleucine, completely hydrophobic, all these hydrocarbons. Here's the side chain of threonine with this big OH making it pretty polar. So threonine is binding in the substrate binding site, and isoleucine is binding in the allosteric inhibitor binding site. Okay, got that. So, the case I provided was a case where the buildup of G, this hypothetical buildup of G, was being caused by really good enzymes in the G pathway compared to the other pathways. So E. coli was controlling its biosynthesis. Now suppose you gave it some G, you gave it some isoleucine. Now we're no longer glucose minimal medium. It's glucose minimal medium plus isoleucine. So you give it isoleucine. So it doesn't really have to make isoleucine at all. Isoleucine goes into the cell. It doesn't know whether it made it or it came from the outside. It really doesn't care. Isoleucine will inhibit this pathway. The exogenous from the environment added isoleucine. So we could add isoleucine. Maybe the E. coli would now grow a little bit faster because it's not wasting some of its glucose making isoleucine. Well, if that works, we could add threonine. Maybe that would inhibit step one, in fact. And we could add glycine, and all the 20 amino acids, and all the nucleic acid precursors we haven't talked about, and some fatty acids, and all the cofactors and prosthetic groups and vitamins like folic acid and pyridoxal phosphate and everything else that E. coli needs. We could think of every monomer and put it in there. Then would E. coli grow a lot faster? The answer is yes. 20 minutes. I could have been bragging about the 20 minutes of E. coli when I tried to impress you with the amazement of E. coli doing this in an hour. But I was saving that for this lecture. You can get E. coli to do this whole business. All right, you're giving it all the monomers, granted, but it's still got to make all these macromolecules. It's got to make its DNA and its membranes and all that, make a whole new E. coli in 20 minutes if you give it a rich medium. You can make it defined that way and buy all the amino acids from Sigma Chemical Company, or you can just grind up a piece of steak and take the juice and add it, and you've got all the stuff you need for E. coli. And that's cheaper. So, our discussion of proteins, we're still sort of in this story, right? We talked about the polysaccharides, the lipids, now we're in the proteins. We have to make a new E. coli, we have to make the proteins. But proteins has gotten us into this long discussion of two big problems that the cell has in making all of this stuff. One is for the reactions that transform the glucose into the various end products necessary to make a new E. coli have to take place in real time, and that is now solved by the use of these proteins that are enzymes as catalysts. The other big problem, which is even just as big, if not bigger problem, is this direction problem, which I pointed out at the beginning of this discussion. To make a fatty acid from glucose requires the input of 300 kilocalories per mole. Where's that going to come from, right? So a lot of these reactions then in... A lot of these reactions are going to require energy, and are therefore going to have arrowheads that are pointing mainly backwards. So how do we circumvent this terrible problem? So let's think about that energy now in more quantitative detail. We had this old energy diagram, which we used to talk about the activation energy, this thought experiment of ripping atoms apart, the actual transition states in the non-catalyzed reaction, the catalyzed reaction with its lower transition state and therefore a lower activation energy and a much higher speed, but the direction is being controlled by the relative levels of AB versus CD. Even if you would take a circuitous route and make E and F from AB in a very favorable reaction and then an unfavorable reaction going all the way uphill back to C and D, doesn't matter. Doesn't matter you had to go uphill here because you went downhill here. What matters is just the total usable energy in A and B versus C and D, no matter how you got there. You go through 100 different transformations, even ones that could never even take place, and you could just think about them. That energy difference is called the free energy difference, and the free energy as opposed to the total energy is the amount of energy that you can actually put in or take out in the form of work. And I won't go further into that in a biology course. It is this free energy that is at the basis, though, of predicting the direction of reactions. So before we deal with the problem of directionality, let's talk quantitatively about this directionality. Let's take a model reaction, general AB goes, A plus B goes to C plus D. And we can define now the change in free energy and choose a scale and a way of measuring that's associated with this chemical reaction and call it the change in free energy. The absolute free energy is of little interest to us and not easily measured. But the change in free energy is easily measured. So we call that delta G. So if delta G is positive, it's defined that if it's positive, and I mentioned this before, that means that A and B, if it's negative, less than zero, it means that A and B will tend to produce C and D, energy will be released. So a negative delta G naught is like a good thing for the direction we're talking about. It tends to go to the right as drawn. Right? And conversely, if delta G is positive, greater than zero, then the reaction will tend to go to the left and energy will be absorbed rather than released. There's only one more logical possibility, and that's delta G is neither positive or negative, it's zero. And in this case, there's no tendency to go in either direction. When delta G equals zero, the reaction is at equilibrium. And although that's only a single point, that's an important point, as you'll see. An equation that describes this change in energy, which I will not derive for you, is one that consists of two parts. Something called delta G naught, which is different from delta G because of the naught, right? And that's called the standard free energy change, the delta meaning the change. We'll talk about that in more detail in a minute. And this more complicated term over here, RTLN, the ratio of the products divided by the product of the reaction. The product of the products divided by the product of the reactants. That looks a lot like the equilibrium constant, right? But it is not the equilibrium constant. The equilibrium constant is this ratio at equilibrium. We are not talking about equilibrium. We are talking about any case where A and B could be anything and C and D could be anything. We want to consider that. What is the free energy change if A is this and B is that and C is that and D is that? That's what it is in the cell. As we measure A, B, C, and D, what is the free energy change as you go from A, B to C and D? Will that take place in the cell under those conditions, not at equilibrium? The other parts of this are rather trivial. R is a universal gas constant, which turns out to be 1.98 calories per degree Kelvin, or degree centigrade mole, which we usually just take to be 2. That's calories, not kilocalories, so you can easily go off by 1,000 when doing one of these problems. T is the absolute temperature in Kelvin, which is 273 at 0 degrees centigrade, 298 at room temperature, and we take it to be 300 usually. And ln is a natural log. The delta G naught part is a constant for any particular reaction that's defined by the A, the B, the C, and the D. It's a quantity related to the intrinsic quality of those chemicals. And it's comparing, really, that's what was on that energy curve, is comparing the stability of the arrangements of the atoms in A and B type case compared to the C and D. And it's independent, then, of the amount that you have. So you have a qualitative term and a quantitative term. Sometimes we'll abbreviate CD over AB, since it's hard to write, as Q for quotient, and to distinguish it from K, which would be the equilibrium constant. So we have a qualitative term depending on what kind of reactants and products we have, and a quantitative term that's related to how much of them we have. And those two terms together determine delta G, and delta G determines the directionality of the reaction under that condition. All this was figured out by Gibbs, and that's why the free energy is delta G and not delta F. What about this delta G naught? Delta G naught then is defined as the standard free energy chain. Standard because it's under a standard condition that we all agree to. And that is that all the reactants and all the products are at unit concentration. So you see, if that's true, then the second term becomes 1 times 1 divided by 1 times 1, and ln of 1 is 0. And so by definition then, delta G equals delta G naught when all these terms in the quantitative part of the equation are 1. So usually this is 1 molar, but sometimes it isn't, as I'll show you in a minute. So this is a very special case when all components are 1, very unusual case. Let's think of what this delta G naught then is. One way to think about it is in a thought experiment. Suppose you had a vat of 1,000 liters, 1 molar A, B, C, and D, and somehow you could stop the reaction from taking place. I say no enzyme, right? So nothing's happening very fast. And you have 1,000 liters at 1 molar. Now you add the enzyme, and you see A and B being, say, converted to C and D. So they say you start all with A and B. And as when 1 mole of those 1,000 moles gets converted from A, B to C and D, at the same time you're measuring the amount of heat given off, it's energy, or heat taken up, if it's going to go that way, right? So you can measure that amount of energy. Meanwhile, you've only gone from 1 molar to 0.99 molar, hasn't really changed the concentration very much, and so that would be the delta G naught. But nobody measures it that way. It's actually very easy to measure delta G naught. And that's because at that equilibrium point, where delta G is equal to 0, we can just fool around with this equation. Since this is our equation for delta G, at equilibrium, it's equal to 0, so we could just rearrange these terms. And since at equilibrium Q, uniquely at equilibrium Q is the equilibrium constant, because that's what the ratio of products to reactants is at equilibrium. So at equilibrium, delta G naught, if we just bring this over to the other side of the equation, delta G naught is just minus RT ln, not Q anymore, but this particular Q, which is equilibrium constant. So we can measure the equilibrium constant by just letting the reaction go to equilibrium, and then measuring how much A, how much B, how much C, how much D we have. We calculate the equilibrium constant, we plug it in here, multiply by RT, and we get our delta G naught. The standard freon, so it's very easy to measure. Let's say we have an equilibrium constant of 2.5 times 10 to the minus 3. That's C and D at equilibrium divided by A and B at equilibrium. Then, if we do the math, we get to 3,600 calories per mole because we used 2 for the universal gas constant. So if we use a 2 times 10 to the minus 3 for kilocalories, then it's 3.6 kilocalories per mole. So this is just an example. It's a positive number. That means when A to B went to C to D in this just made-up case, energy was absorbed. This is an unfavorable reaction. It's obviously unfavorable. The equilibrium is very small in terms of getting A and B going to C and D. There's very little C and D form from A and B. So energy is required for this reaction. Now, you can note, there's lots of problems like this in the book. If delta G is plus 3.6 for this reaction as written, we can just turn the reaction around, everything gets reversed, all the ratios and whatever, and you'll see that the sign comes out just the opposite. So if we consider C to D going to A plus B, we get a delta G naught of minus 3.6. And indeed, the equilibrium constant is 1 over 2.5 times 10 to the minus 3, or 400. Right? Another special case we don't usually run into, I mean you run into in nature but not in the course, it's too complicated, is we've been assuming that one mole of A reacts with one mole of B to give one mole of C and one mole of D. Real life is more complicated. You could have two moles of A and one mole of B and two moles of D and one mole. So just like with equilibrium constants, when you calculate that quotient, Q, you have to raise the concentrations of the reactants and products to the coefficient of molarity that defines the stoichiometry of the reaction. Okay. Now, I said that delta G naught, we all agree, is the standard free energy change when all the reactants and products are at one unit concentration. So why is he saying unit concentration instead of molar, right? Most of the time it is molar, but there are a couple of exceptions. One exception is water. For aqueous reactions that take place in aqueous environment, we and the chemists all agree that it's silly to talk about change in water. The water concentration is never really changing. It's 55 molar. Even if it takes part in the reaction, it's not changing very much. So it simplifies all our calculations a lot if we just count water as one unit constant. 55 molar is considered one. Is that sounds like cheating, but it's not cheating because we're in charge of this. This is all a construct of how we look at energy. So instead of writing 55, we write 1. That little telephone should be a delta. So we all agree to that. There's another exception that that biochemists like to use, because biochemists generally work at 10 to the minus 7th molar hydrogen ions, that is neutrality pH 7, whether they're doing their reactions in the test tube or in living systems. Most of the reactions taking place at pH 7 because living systems are buffered to keep the hydrogen ion concentration constant at 10 to the minus 7. So we say, well, instead of saying 10 to the minus 7th, since hydrogen ion concentration really doesn't change because there are other mechanisms that keep it always the same, we're going to call 10 to the minus 7th also 1. Right? And the chemists say, well, that's all well and good, but we can't do that. We're always adding acids and bases, acid-catalyzed reactions, and we add a base, and we can't do that. I'm sorry. So you can't call delta G naught. Define it with 1. If you have to call something else, right? So you say, okay, we'll call it delta G naught prime. You say, okay, delta G naught prime. So often in the books you'll see delta G naught prime, right? So we all agree this is delta G naught prime, it's not delta G naught. But I won't bother putting the prime in, and most of us don't, right? And the chemists don't know how they really feel about it. But we should understand, when we talk in biology about delta G naught, it's really rigorously delta G naught prime, where both hydrogen ions and water are considered unit concentrations at something other than one molar. These delta G naughts Since they're independent now of concentration, they can be determined for any reaction that you write down. And you can actually figure them out from first principles. They're not very accurate. Better to run the reaction and measure the equilibrium constant. If you can't do that, there are ways of doing it by using other reactions and making this reaction work on paper, but they're not too accurate. Any of these reactions that we have, these thousands of reactions in the cell, they all have delta G naughts, and they're all written down in some book or another, which means the equilibrium constant for these reactions is known too. So let's consider now a change in free energy that takes place in a real reaction, not A's and B's. And for our first exemplary reaction, we'll take the one that all the texts take, and rightly so, because it's a very important reaction in the consideration of how the cell treats energy, and that is the hydrolysis of something called ATP. So we'll start with that. It's as good an example of any, and it's better actually than most. So, but unfortunately, we can't talk about something easy like ethanol or serine. It's a more complicated molecule, but it shouldn't scare you, because we know these what these abbreviations mean. We got carbons here, and there's a lot of nitrogens in this part, which is hanging up, sticking up off the top. And as you can see, it's got an NH2, which in at pH 7 is going to be positively charged, and at least one of these is going to be positively charged. A lot of bases. It's called a base. And it's a nucleic acid base. It's called adenine, which is not on this graphic 30. So that's adenine. And adenine is attached by a covalent bond to this sugar. It looks a little like glucose, but wait, it's only got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 carbons. So it's a pentose and it's ribose, in fact. Ribose makes this little 5-membered ring, again with a carbon hanging off. That's the carbon 5. And that's 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, a little review of our sugars. So in fact, this adenine is attached to the anomeric carbon, which is the active carbon, like in glycosidic bonds, also this bond. But this isn't so active. Nevertheless, it's put together here as ATP. The other side of the sugar then is attached to a phosphate, which we met in phospholipids. But this one has got like 3 in a row. So here we recognize this is a phosphoester bond. There was a CH2OH alcohol here. The phosphate is an acid. So the acid and alcohol makes an ester. Now we have another phosphate, and in fact this was created by another dehydration reaction, like all these reactions that put things together. But this is not an ester because it's two acids. An acid and an acid get together, lose water, condense together, like that. And it's a new functional group that you don't need for the exam, but you'll need for exam number 2, which is the acid anhydride. That's a new functional group. You see them in biological compounds. Right here you see them. Now let's consider the hydrolysis of ATP, which means we're going to add water and break off one of those phosphates. The reaction we'll talk about, and that's most common, is the ATP, which is adenosine. I should have said that back here. When the adenine is connected to the ribose, it changes its name to A connected to R. It can be represented symbolically like that, or called the English word adenosine. These are 3 phosphates called triphosphate, so this is familiarly known as adenosine triphosphate, or ATP. So its hydrolysis then would give you only diphosphate left, so I just say ADP, you can imagine what that looks like, and the free phosphate, which I will now abbreviate as PI, which is a standard biochemical abbreviation, so we don't have to write all those O's and H's. That's just the free phosphate group, or inorganic, the I stands for inorganic, there's no carbon in that thing, inorganic phosphate. So you can also imagine 2 phosphates taken off, and then you would have something called adenosine monophosphate, and it stands to reason in terms of English naming. Now, the delta G naught of this reaction is about -7 kilocalories per mole. So the minus tells you this is a favorable reaction, it's going to the right, and the 7 seems like a kind of a, is that a big number or a little number? Energy is released. It's an exergonic reaction because energy is released. If it were positive, it would be an endergonic reaction. It goes strongly to the right, and in fact, if you figure out the equilibrium constant, it's about 100,000 to the right. So it's very strongly to the right. molecules, reactions, hydrolysis reactions, that release about 7 kilocalories per mole or more. That is, they have a minus 7 or a bigger negative number, a smaller number, minus 7, minus 10. They are called high energy bonds, which is a misnomer because the bond itself is not of high energy. In fact, it's so easily broken, it wants to be broken, to give off all this energy. But it's a convenient term to distinguish a high energy bond from a non-high energy bond. High energy bond means when it's hydrolyzed, specifically added water to, it releases 7 kilocalories per mole or more of free energy. And when we're talking about it, we can change the bond from a straight line to a squiggle so we know which one we're talking about. So in ATP, we might write it, if we're talking about energy, as APP with a squiggle P for the terminal phosphate. You can rationalize this high release so much energy because look at these negative charges. They're all clustered together here in a very repulsive situation. If they would add water, that electrical tension is relieved to some extent. These are still there. But with this free phosphate, the molecules are in a more stable state, and so you have a big free energy change. What about another reaction that's less famous but still takes place? ADP getting go further hydrolyzed to AMP and PI, right? What's the delta G naught of that? Again, for the same reason, minus 7 kilocalories per mole because you have all this electrical tension. So you could draw both of these last two phosphates attached with squiggles. However, the first phosphate's just attached by this ester bond, which doesn't have this electrical tension properties, and in fact, it's more like minus 3 or something. So it's not a high energy bond. So, one way of looking at this reaction is that we would get, if I had, say, 1 milliliter of a 1 molar solution of ATP in a little test tube here, and or I dissolved it into a 1 milliliter of water, what would happen? We would get hydrolysis and evolution of heat, which has energy has to go somewhere. So the energy is released in these kilocalories, then there's no place else for it to go except raise the temperature of that solution. So I should feel this tube get a little warmer. How much warmer? Well, a calorie raises 1 gram or 1 milliliter of water, 1 degree centigrade. So this is 7 kilocalories. So it should go up 7,000 degrees? No, because I only have 1 milliliter of 1 molar solution. So I only have 1/1000th of a mole. So it's only 7 degrees, which is good. I won't burn my hand. So when I do that, however, I feel no heat whatsoever. Why? Because the activation energy, it could stay for days. This ATP would stay there. It's not all that stable. After months, probably it would, or even weeks, perhaps, it would be hydrolyzed in the absence of a catalyst. So I have to add a little ATPase, some enzyme that can catalyze this reaction. I put that in there, in 1 minute, sure enough, the tube gets warm. I've never done that experiment, but I'm confident of the result. Okay, how can we harness now? We're looking for a source of energy. How can we harness that that energy? In fact, the hydrolysis of ATP is used to drive reactions that require energy. So let's take a reaction that requires energy and see how we can put these two together. A nice example is the very first reaction that glucose undergoes when it gets into that E. coli cell. It gets phosphorylated. A phosphate is tacked on to the sixth position of glucose, and you get glucose 6-phosphate. You get that phosphoester. This reaction here. The delta G naught of that reaction is plus 3.6 kilocalories per mole. Bad. Here we have all this glucose, and we're having trouble just getting started. But very little of it made with that K equilibrium. we have this other reaction maybe available, ATP giving 7 kilocalories per mole. So let's put these two in a test tube and consider what's this mixture going to do. First of all, on the left we have ATP, we have the water, we have glucose, we have phosphate. And our products then that we're considering is to form ADP, generate phosphate from the ADP, add the phosphate to glucose to make G6P, and actually also generate water. So you'll notice though, and we can consider all these as A plus B plus C plus D, and this E plus F plus G plus H, and we can calculate a delta G naught. It's minus 3. In fact, it's just the arithmetic sum of these two delta Gs for the two separate reactions. So you can do this for these energy diagrams and for these calculations. You can just add whatever you want on the left, whatever you want on the right, as long as you have information, and there's plenty of practice for this in problem set 4. So for this overall reaction, delta G naught is just the sum, and it's favorable. And in fact, we can simplify this reaction because water's going in on the left and right, phosphate's going in on the left and right, so we can write this more simply as just glucose plus ATP. The net reaction, the net sum, is the net sum of the delta G's and the net sum of the reactants and products. That's just the product we want, our G6P. So this should be good. So I'll take my test tube and I'll put in ATP and glucose and water and some phosphate. And what happens? Nothing happens because I don't have any enzymes yet. Okay, I don't want to add, so I could add the ATPase to break down the ATP and get those 7 kilocalories per mole. And I could add something that adds phosphate to glucose, say glucose phosphorylase. Let's say there's such an enzyme. It takes phosphate and glucose and would catalyze the reaction, poor though it be in directionality. It'll do it. It'll do it in the other direction very well. So I put those together, and what do I feel? Should feel, I see, I feel the same 7 degrees goes up. All the ATP is 1 minute hydrolyzed to ADP and phosphate, and all the energy goes off in raising those water molecules' motion, and temperature goes up 7 degrees, and the glucose is sitting there. Well, it's not just sitting there, it's moving faster, okay? It's moving faster. It's going to collide better with the phosphate. So maybe that's a way, is that a way to couple these two reactions? Not really, because your body's not going to allow you to go up 7 degrees even, because your temperature is kept constant, and E. coli too in our bodies. So raising the temperature is not a practical way to couple these two reactions. So we still haven't solved the problem. This I said. So the answer, my friends, lies in a different enzyme. Smarter enzyme, hexokinase. Forget the ATPase, forget the glucose phosphorylase, we just put one enzyme in. And what that enzyme does, and forget the inorganic phosphate. So all we want to do is this net reaction. This enzyme will bind glucose, it will bind ATP, and we'll take the very phosphate off of the ATP and transfer it right to the glucose 6-phosphate. That's what the enzymes are good for. Specificity. What's the delta G naught of this reaction? We just did it. It's minus 3.4. We're home. We don't have to go through this heat business. This is a coupled reaction. And a coupled reaction is not the two reactions. In a way, it's a misnomer. Because a coupled reaction is a brand new reaction. It has the same reactants and products that we wrote down for the two reactions that we temporarily thought maybe would work. But in fact, it's a new reaction. And this is how, this is one of the two ways, there's two ways that directionality can be controlled. This is how the delta G is sort of manipulated by the cell to run reactions that are more complicated than the original reaction, just phosphate to glucose. So we make a more complicated reaction. We take ATP and glucose and transfer. It's a more complicated reaction, but it gets the job done because the directionality is now in our favor. What a good strategy. The second strategy we'll discuss later, next time. Lots of these reactions require energy input. ATP is the usual guy who does this. A new reaction involving ATP is used, and that's why ATP is called the energy currency of the cell. So, does this solve the problem? We have E. coli growing in glucose minimal medium. Where's this ATP coming from? Sigma Chemical Company? No. We have to make the ATP. E. coli's got to make everything. If you start with glucose and make ATP molecule, that takes energy. It takes ATP, coupled reactions. I'm going in circles here. No. Actually, it's a little simpler than that. Yeah. You have a class in here?
All right, running over.
Okay. Then we will continue next time with this story. There's only one more minute.